Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. We're in the E section of the X directory of the Slackware packages. First package in the list for today is egl-wayland, and that's followed promptly by egl external platform. I'm going to talk about both simultaneously, or rather together, because they're basically, I mean, they're both about EGL. And EGL is it stands for embedded-system. So you're getting two letters for the price of one there. Embedded System Graphics Library. It is an API. Well, I'll read it straight, the little introductory sentence out of the specification itself. This document describes EGL, an interface between rendering APIs such as OpenCL, OpenGL, OpenGLES, or OpenVG, referred to collectively as client APIs, and one or more underlying platforms, typically Windows systems, such as X11. So in other words, EGL ensures that a client API for a rendering service like OpenGL or Vulkan or OpenCL or whatever, it could be other ones too, it makes sure that those are kind of what can interact and integrate with a windowing system. That's a lot of specialized terminology, arguably jargon, sort of crammed into one sentence, and it might not make a whole lot of sense, but I gave this some thought, and I think there might be a somewhat relatable analogy to make here, and that is for a graphical application that I'm working on in my spare time that does mapping. It's a map software, but on a grid layout. Let's say that it's essentially making it helps you design a castle with walls and doors and towers and things like that. Now these relate to physical components. So I knew that the pieces that I'm using are 40 millimeters wide. I knew that. So I knew that in the software that the most logical way to allow the software to help me build something physical in software was, well, I could think of two different ways. One was to make it sort of lay out, do it on a grid, or two is have kind of snapping sensitivity so that when you get one piece close enough to it, the other, they snap together on the edges, and kind of it would ensure that you have a very very regular kind of spacing in the map that you're creating, which is what I wanted. This is for a tabletop game, and so I need corridors and rooms and things like that to be predictable and laid out on a grid. So I figured the grid idea was probably the best idea, especially since the analog version of this activity is done on graph paper. So I'm working on this software, and I'm trying to think of how do you get a grid on, or specifically a something to represent 40 millimeters, which like 4 centimeters, right? So that's what about 2 inches. That's the size of space that I need. Now, it doesn't have to literally be, I don't have to hold a ruler up to my monitor, my screen, and confirm that it's actually 40 millimeters, but I do need the software to be aware that the smallest measure of a unit of measure that it requires is X, which you and I know is 40 millimeters, but we'll call it X. And so when I move a piece of a wall or a door or something 5 spaces over, then each of those spaces needs to be X amount of space. So there are lots of different ways of creating a grid in a computer application. And one of those ways is to just to ensure that in any action that you take finds where your cursor is on the screen and then calculates where within some number of X units that falls. So for instance, if you're, 400 pixels to the right of the far left of your screen, then we could calculate at a certain, if we're zooming in, zooming out, we can calculate, well, we must be four X units to the right. And that, of course, would tell us, okay, well, we're at 100 pixels per unit right now. The other way, though, is to create a library that defines a grid. And then every time you move your mouse cursor, you can ask that library, where on the grid am I? So in other words, you can either, in your code, you could program it such that when you click, or when you right click, or whatever action you would be taking to figure out where your mouse is, figure out how many pixels, you know, over from the edge you are, and then figure out what the correct grid size would be, and then where your mouse is within that grid, and then you place the tile, the piece of thing that you want to place on the map, you place that within the grid by centering it within whatever grid cell your mouse cursor happens to be in, because obviously you don't want your user to have to only click exactly in the middle of that grid cell. Like you just want to make generalities. Okay, your mouse cursor is within this grid space, therefore when you place a tile, it goes into that cell centered every single time. Or, as I say, you can create a library, and that way every time you click, you just make a call to that library, which has one time calculated things. It knows how to calculate where the mouse is and what cell you're within. And then you get the cell number back and you place the tile into that cell number. That's really kind of what a graphics library sort of and a windowing system is for your computer. It is that library in the background that has concepts within your screen that your computer shouldn't really know about. To your computer, a screen is just a big array of pixels. 1920 pixels across, 1080 pixels down, or however big your screen is. And that's just a big matrix, right? That's just a big array of pixels. And when you move something on your screen, your computer could do the math and figure out where the thing was a millisecond ago, and then figure out what pixels to draw so that, well, what pixels to erase or, you know, draw over with blank space in order, and then what pixels to draw in order to make it look like the thing that you have moved has moved. Of course, nothing's really moving on a screen. It's just pixels. It's like a ticker tape, like one of those stock listings around big buildings in Times Square. It's just pixels that turn off and on again, with lots and lots of different values, obviously. But if you have a rendering engine involved, it can do those calculations for you. You don't have to figure that out in your own application, which has not always been the case. Like, if you look back at the old, you know, like, DOS computer programs or incursus applications today within Linux, well, even incursus, I mean, that's a library that's providing you a bunch of abilities so that you don't have to calculate a bunch of stuff. But at one point in time, like, that was as much sort of movement as you could have on a screen. As a programmer, you could sit there and say, okay, well, if someone presses return and this item is, and they last moved to this item with their arrow key, then they have sort of quote unquote pressed a button. And so we'll make that button for a brief couple of seconds, or maybe a second or half a second, we'll make it look like it's been pressed in. So we'll change the color of these pixels. I mean, a programmer really only has to do that once before they realize, okay, well, I need to abstract this out to a library. And so that's what happened pretty quickly, I would imagine. People realized that, yes, we can do little tiny animations by inverting some pixels, but we don't want to have to program that every single time, so we'll make a library to do that for us. And that evolved eventually, maybe not directly, but that thinking evolved into graphics libraries, rendering engines, and so on. Now, So that's what provides the graphical sort of movement, the pictures that we see on the screen. But in order for those pictures on the screen to take the structured form that we expect on a computer, we have a windowing system. And the windowing system is the thing with the concept of windows. I mean, that's what it's for. So out of this big array of pixels that we have to work with, let's start to containerize, let's kind of cordon off little sections, and we'll put some decoration around it to make it really clear which section is what. But we'll call these windows or panels or whatever we call them on that particular OS, although I think everyone's pretty much decided that it's just called a window now. But that's where we get the concepts of windows, because we have a windowing system that understands that when an application launches, it doesn't take over your entire screen. It launches in a little containerized graphical section. And I don't mean containerized in the sense of kernel Linux containers. I mean the defined area that is a window. So for a graphic renderer to be able to render an application within a defined area, there needs to be those two things need to be talking to each other. And that's one of the things that EGL provides. I mean, with a class such as EGL display, I mean that tells you where your screen is at all. But then further within EGL, figuring out, okay, well, what are we calling a window? How big is a window? How do we know when it's being resized? How do we know when it's being moved? How do we know when to refresh it or when to hide it if it's being minimized and so on? All of that stuff is taken care of by the windowing system, and it is able to look good and to have moving pixels and so on because of the rendering, whatever's rendering graphics on your system. Those two things, the rendering and the windows, they talk to each other because of EGL. Next package is encoding, or encodings. It's the X11 package that contains a map of what happens when you press a specific key on a keyboard. So it takes the code that the keyboard sends to the computer and literally maps it to a specific character. It's kind of the stuff that we take for granted, so you don't really probably need to look at it, but if you want to look at an encoding file, you can. It's, just looking at var log packages shows where these are located. They're all gzipped, so they are compressed, but using less invisibly, silently un-gzips it for you so you can see it. So if you do something like /usr/share/fonts/encodings with an S at the end, slash, for instance, ISO 8859-13.enc for encodings, .gz, you see exactly what I've described. It's a code on the left and a code on the right of what character, you know, like the keyboard and then the character, and then a very friendly comment on the right telling you what all of this actually translates to. So 0xc0 conveys or displays, I guess, 0x0104, which is the Latin capital letter A with ogonek, O-G-O-N-E-K. I don't know what an ogonek is. Oh, it's a diacritic hook placed under the lower right corner of a vowel in several European and Native American languages. Now I know what an ogonek is. So anyway, that's the encoding files. Hundreds and hundreds of lines of one code and another code, pressing a key, receiving a value. Now let's talk about FCITX. There's a bunch of packages within sort of the FCITX package set, I guess, and they're all basically this. They're not the same, but they're all contributing to the FCITX input method. That's what FCITX is. It's an input method, often abbreviated in configuration files and so on as IM, input method. You'll see that sometimes. You'll see that in FCITX configuration, which we're going to go through in a moment here. FCITX is it's kind of an intermediary application that connects to your dbus session and kind of intercepts the things that you type on your keyboard such that something else can be displayed. This is useful for languages that use characters that don't appear on a standard keyboard or with so many characters that they wouldn't fit on a keyboard. So for instance, Chinese and Japanese. I'm going to use Chinese in this example for no reason other than, it's oddly synchronous. There was a Chinese calligraphy workshop in town last weekend, and I happened to attend just out of curiosity. Calligraphy sounds cool. Don't know anything about Chinese. Might as well go learn because it's the Moon Festival right now. Or is it, Moon Lantern Festival? Yeah, Moon Festival, I think. Or the Lantern Festival. I don't know. One of those two things, or both, is sort of, at the time of recording, happening right now. So I did this on a whim. And I can write things in some things in Chinese now. I can write the sun. I can write moon. I can write, I think, something like good luck and new gold mountain. Those are the things that I can write in. And person. I know the person symbol. That's an easy one. It's kind of like an upside down Y. So anyway, point is, I learned like 5 Chinese characters over just this past weekend. And so I just feel like that's the way to go. Okay. So SCITX, it is an application, as I said, that's going to run kind of in the background. So there's the SCITX component that you need to start. There's some configuration that you need to do, like environment variables and stuff. And for simplicity, and there's configuration for SCITX. And then for simplicity, there are some, there's a widget in the Plasma desktop that you probably ought to start. There are equivalents for GNOME. I didn't try it in XFCE, although that is actually usually what my virtual machine is running. So I've only tried the Plasma desktop stuff. But I'm imagining it's all pretty similar, and I imagine you could run a bunch of these different. You have a lot of different options for how you interact with this in terms of sort of the meta interaction, like which input method am I using right now? That's probably not something you're going to turn on and off frequently. I think the intended use here is that you're at a computer and your input method is pinyin or whatever. Then that's probably primarily the way you're going to be interacting with your computer. This isn't, I don't think, this is sort of intended as a thing where, I think I'll do a cheeky Chinese character or Japanese character right here and then go back to normal typing. Yeah, I don't think that's the intent. I think it's kind of meant to be on or off. That said, with a widget, you can turn it on and off just like that, like super easy. So those are the components. SCITX, configuration of SCITX, your system configuration, and then your desktop configuration. So 4 components. I think the thing to start with, I think, that makes the most sense to me is the system configuration, because that's something you can set up and then kind of forget about, really. And then you'll also, I found that you have to log out. You shouldn't have to log out. You should just be able to source this file and everything should work. That is not what happened with in my case. I might have done something wrong, or there might be some other trick that I didn't know about, but I just ended up logging out, logging back on. Okay, so the system configuration that you need to do is pretty simple. It's like literally 2 lines in your home directory in a file called .bash_profile. It needs to be .bash_profile in my experience, because I think I saw somewhere that that's what SDDM wants to look at or something like that. Maybe it's .bashrc as well, but I hadn't logged out and logged out. The one that worked for me ultimately was .bash_profile. So that's what I'm going to advise. And you have to put 2 lines in there. One is export space qt_im_module. That's QT. This is all capitals. qt_im as an input method _module equals, and then lowercase FCITX. And you're exporting that. So export space qt_im_module equals FCITX. Done. Next line, export space GTK underscore IM underscore module equals FCITX. Those are the two lines you need in .bash underscore profile in your home directory. Now, the cute one is maybe obvious. If you're familiar with the Plasma desktop at all, you know it's based on the cute library widget set, or the cute framework, I guess. So you're telling your computer through this environment variable that your input method module is FCITX. The GTK one you may not think you need immediately because you think, well, I'm running Plasma desktop. What do I need GTK for? Well, there's probably some application out there that you're using that uses GTK. So yes, you're still using this environment variable. So have those two in .bash underscore profile. And then, as I said, just log out of your desktop and then log back in. I don't mean reboot or restart or anything like that. I just mean go to the K menu and select, power session or whatever it shows up as yours, and just log out so that you're back at your login screen, type in your password again, and start the desktop again. Like I said, technically, you should just be able to do a source.bash underscore profile, and it should work, but I did not have great experience with that. Okay, so that's the configuration of the system. That's done. Next is to start FCITX because you can't configure FCITX without it running. Your configuration tool won't be able to connect to FCITX or connect FCITX to dbus, so it needs to be running. And the way that you can start this is FCITX ampersand. There, you've started it. I mean, you type that into your terminal, FCITX ampersand, and then it starts running in the background. There's an auto start function that I didn't play around with, but you could use that to get FCITX to start reliably all the time, or you could just put it into your .bash underscore profile, FCITX ampersand, and then it's running in the background, I imagine. Okay, so I just started it manually, FCITX, ampersand, now it's running. Now you can configure the F. So that's one component, your system configuration, done. FCITX, running, done. Now you need to configure FCITX. And then after that, we'll do the desktop thing. So to configure this, I'm trying to type into my virtual machine, forgetting that it is set to this Chinese input method. And I'm realizing that is not going to work for me because I do not know Chinese. So FCITX-config tool is the command to launch the little setting, the input method setting window. So FCITX-config tool. Config tool being one string. FCITX-config tool. That launches a little system setting module, and it's labeled input method. So you could probably get here from system settings. I don't know. I just typed it in manually because that's what was in the package. And this is a little bit confusing. It does warn you at the bottom of the window the parameters that are required, but it is not great English, and so it is very difficult to understand. I missed it. I read it. I just didn't understand it, so I just kind of assumed it didn't mean anything. But so the first input method will be inactive state. Usually you need to put keyboard or keyboard layout name in the first place. Okay, so what that is telling you is that everything in this window, in this tab, is required information, even if you think that your system should already know. So default keyboard layout at the very top of this tab, select default keyboard layout. You have to do that, even though you already have a default keyboard layout on your system. So click that button and find the keyboard layout that you want to use. I'm using keyboard English US English Dvorak, but you might use something different. Whatever it is, you have to select it there. Confusingly, after you select it, it won't look like you've selected anything. The button won't change. It'll still be a button for select default keyboard layout. It's a little bit unnerving. You will think, have I done that yet? Yes, you've done it. As long as you've done it once, you're fine. Okay, so you've done that. Then in the second section of this tab is the select input method section. And this is, again, a little confusing. At the bottom of that list, of the big list of all the different options that you have, there is a little checkbox that's labeled only show current languages. And at least on mine, pretty reliably, that's been turned on by default. The problem with that is that kind of constrains the list to literally just, in my case, English. So it doesn't show you all the other options like Chinese and Japanese and, you know, all of the things that you would be using FCITX for. So you need to uncheck that box to open up all the different options. Once you've done that, you can find the language that you are attempting to configure for FCITX. I didn't recognize any of them because I don't know anything about other languages, really. So, certainly not Chinese or Japanese. And I think it said Cyrillic as well. So I just don't know enough about those to make informed decisions, but I have heard the term Pinyin, which apparently is like a simplified, not simplified Chinese. There is simplified Chinese as well. Pinyin, I think, is sort of a simplified, but not simplified, version of the glyphs. So that's what I chose, Cantonese Pinyin. That's, and I know nothing about that choice. That's just what I settled on. So I chose that. You can choose something else. And once you're done there, then you're done. You can, you select it in the left panel and then click the arrow button in the middle, and that moves it over to the right panel. So you'll see English, US, Dvorak, possibly, at the top, depending on what your keyboard is, and then you'll see Cantonese Pinyin. And the one that is selected is the one that your system sees as your input method now. So you can say okay to that or whatever. And then what I did to make it a little bit easier for me was I went to my KDE panel and right-clicked on it and said add widgets. And then I looked through the list of plasmoids or widgets, whatever we're calling them these days, and found the one called input method. Manage your input methods. That is different from input method panel, a generic input method panel. I could not get input method panel to work. As far as I could tell, it is an empty panel. I don't know what its intent, what it's supposed to do, but it didn't do anything for me. So I use input method, manage your input methods. And it looks like a little keyboard, sort of. It's a keyboard with like a dialogue bubble or something like that. So, or a keyboard that is a dialogue bubble, I think is what that's supposed to represent. So I click that and add that to my little panel here. And then from there, I have this little sort of keyboard icon. And if I roll over that, it says no input window. I don't know what that means, unfortunately. But if I right click on it, then there's a bunch of different options like toggle virtual keyboard. That was not useful for me in any way. Virtual keyboard, again, not useful for me. Input method, there we go. Input method right now is keyboard English, US English, Dvorak. The other option is Cantonese Pinyin. So I'm going to select Cantonese Pinyin. Now I'm going to open up a terminal window, and I'm going to type fu, or fu, fu, anyway. Fu, I think, is how you say it. I'm sure I'm wrong. And as a pop-up window, as I type, it gives me five different options for what, I don't know what these options are for, but I guess it's kind of like an autocomplete or something. And it's giving me a bunch of Chinese characters that, you know, again, I don't understand because I don't know enough about it. But I'm going to hit just one to select the first one in that list. And now I've got a Chinese character in my terminal. If I do Xi, C-H-I, again, probably mispronouncing that. Then let's take the third option. I don't know what any of these are, and hopefully I'm not saying anything rude. Here's a J-I, there's one. I'll take the fifth option from that, hit five. So in other words, the rhythm seems to be, and again, this is from someone who does not actually use this in real life ever. This is my second time using the system. But the rhythm seems to be you type something on your English keyboard, like A, and then you see a pop-up sort of autocomplete of what, I guess, what character you're possibly trying to construct. And I wish I could remember some of the words from the calligraphy workshop, because then maybe I could type something and see if... Oh, sun, I think. S-U-N was one. None of these look familiar to me, so I don't think that means anything. Okay, I mean, it does mean something, but I don't remember what. Anyway, so you type something, and you get this almost an autocomplete window that is numbered, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then there's even a little arrow for more options over at the top, so I guess you can keep going if there are more. Yeah, it looks like there are. But there's always 5 selections, and so eventually, once you see what you want, I mean, I guess you could probably continue to type, maybe. I'm not sure how it works. But once you see the selection that you want, you hit the number key of the character you want. And I could legitimately imagine that not being that bad. Like, I always used to think, like, how is it possible to have, like, a sequence of characters resulting in one character? Wouldn't that just take forever? But it actually, no, I could totally see this working. Like, I could, yeah, I think it's a little bit like Emacs or like the compose key. After you get into the rhythm of typing, there seems to be less of an expectation that one key press results in exactly one thing. Like, it's okay if multiple key presses are required to render one thing, which surprises me on the one hand, but then on the other hand, thinking back to, yeah, things like Emacs and the compose key, it's not that big of a deal at all, actually. I mean, I use the compose key all the time, like all the time. I use compose characters all the time. So the idea that it takes 3 key presses to get one specific character isn't really a foreign concept. And so I could actually maybe imagine possibly using a keyboard layout or an input method, I guess, more specifically, that does require more than one key press to render exactly one thing. That's FCITX. Once again, there are 4 components. System, you know, environment variables, right? System configuration. FCITX starting, FCITX configuring, and then desktop input configuring. 4 components, you set those up and you're typing in Chinese or Japanese or any other any number of other languages that require something other than a 1-for-1 correlation between keys and characters. I think it's time for coffee. Let's break. We're back with coffee. I'm trying a brand new coffee, something I've never tried before, I don't think. It is, of course, from Flight Coffee, my go-to coffee supplier. And, I mean, other than the bin store an hour away. But I didn't get to the bin store, so I just mail ordered, or whatever we call it these days, internet. Yeah, it's through the post, so whatever. Mail ordered some coffee from Flight Coffee. And this one, I mean, you know, dear listener, you know me. I love a mild coffee. I really do. I mean, it's not that I want my coffee to have no flavor or anything like that. It's just I like a mild brew. It just goes down easy. It's smooth. I like it. But this time around, I thought, you know what? I want something a little bit darker. I want something a little bit bolder. And there was a coffee that I'd not seen before on the site, and it's called Memphis. Now, I've been reading about ancient Rome and ancient Egypt for a while now, for a long time. But most recently, I've been reading about the 7 Cleopatras in the Ptolemy line. And not many people know, I don't think, that there were 7 of them. The Cleopatra we know was the 7th, but there were a bunch of Cleopatras before her. And because I've been reading about Rome and Egypt, one of the cities or regions, well, cities that comes up now and again is, of course, Memphis, probably not pronounced Memphis. There's also a Memphis in the United States, in the state of Tennessee, Memphis. So there is that one, but there's another one in Egypt called Memphis. And because I've been reading about it a lot, I just thought, and because I was in the mood for a darker coffee, this coffee came up and it said, hey, I'm a dark, bold coffee with notes of this and that, and I'm called Memphis. I just thought, this is it. This is the sign I've been looking for. So I purchased a kilo of Memphis. And I have to say, for the first couple of pots of coffee, I was sorely disappointed because, and this is not unusual, by the way. When you get a new coffee, sometimes you have to kind of find your way around that coffee. You have to figure out, well, how does it want, as it were, to be brewed? How much coffee do I put into, you know, the little basket in my percolator or the basket in my stovetop mocha pot? So this is not an unusual occurrence. The first, you know, with a net new coffee, the first couple of cups often are not the best cups. So I did suffer a little bit initially, but I wasn't worried. I knew that this was kind of just the getting to know you stage. And this morning, taking all of my lessons from the past couple of days, I made an amazing pot of coffee. I've been drinking it all morning long. It has been great. I look forward to making another one. This is a nice coffee. I mean, it isn't as dark, honestly, as I had kind of expected. So in a way, it's kind of a really perfect dark coffee for me. It's notably darker than a lot of the other ones that I get, Milky and Bomber and Cozy. But the big cozy, that's the name of the coffee. But it's not like, you know, it's not like a dark espresso roast. So it's kind of nice. I've really been enjoying it, and I've got a kilo of it, so I'll be drinking it for a while. Although I did get some small bags of the Big Cozy, so I might, you know, dip over to the Big Cozy sometimes before the winter is over. I mean, technically the winter is over. It's officially spring by the calendar, but it still feels like winter right now. Okay, so that's what I'm drinking. I hope you have an excellent cup of coffee as well. It might not be Memphis, but hopefully it's very, very good. Maybe you're in Memphis. Who knows? Either one of them. The next set of packages we have to talk about are a little bit difficult to talk about. They're font packages. There are literally 35 of them. I don't have that much to say about a bunch of different fonts. So instead of sort of just talking about each and every single font, I think I'm going to talk about fonts. And the first thing to know about Linux and fonts, about Linux and fonts, I was going to say Slackware specifically, but I guess Linux and fonts, is that there is a little bit of a, I don't want to say split brain, but I don't know another term for it. Split brain sounds like there's a conflict, but there's really not. It's just there's two different systems at play here. There's the console fonts that you see if you were to boot up Slackware, for instance, in run level 3. There's no graphic server running. There's no rendering happening. This is just pixels on a screen. Those are your console fonts. And some of those are in here. Font Sun Misc 1.03. Font Screen Cyrillic. Well, actually, maybe I'm not sure about that one. But yeah, there's some in here that are not intended. I think font-IBM-Type1, I think that's a console font. Some of these, and I could be wrong, I could be misremembering the different ones, but some of these, or maybe all of these are. Let's just go to the source instead of just guessing. Let's do a less on var log packages, font-, I think Sun was one of them. These are PCF fonts. These aren't TTF fonts. These are console fonts. These are things that you can choose to display as a font when you don't have a graphic server running, when you've got nothing like There's no, I'm not talking about like you boot to a desktop and then you launch a terminal. I mean, it's the part before you launch even the desktop, much less the display manager, the session manager, whatever we're calling it, SDDM. It's just pixels on a screen. So that's one font system, and it requires a specific kinds of fonts, a kind of font. It has its own little back end, its own little font config stuff. That's one set of fonts. And then there's a completely different set of fonts for the graphic server, for the stuff that's going to be rendered for you to look at. And that's the TTFs and the OTFs and so on. So a lot of these are the PCF fonts. They make your console look slightly different. I mean, I've gone through a lot of the console fonts when you're installing Slack, where you get to choose, or you can choose if you want, what font to use. And I have to admit, a lot of them are really, really similar. Or they're not, maybe you could probably argue that they're not similar, but to a lazy eye that's just like, look, I just need to know what letter I'm typing, a lot of them are very similar. I used to run with the Sun font for a long time. But that was just literally just because, like, I had the option, I might as well change it. And that was one of the ones that looked different enough from the starting point that I thought, yeah, I can kind of tell that that's different. And then there's, like I say, the server, the X11 font. And the way that X11 and most systems, I think, manage fonts is that they assume that your font is installed at a system level for all users to see, and they are meant as essentially rendering artifacts, like not artifacts, but rendering like components, things to be rendered on screen. And that's the kind of mentality when you go to system settings and you're playing around with what your system looks like, and you decide, you know what, I've just looked at this same window decoration for my entire, for years now, ever since 15.0 came out, been looking at the same thing. I'm gonna mix it up. I'm gonna put a serif font at the top of my on the top of each window, and so you choose a different font. Well, that's you're not bundling a font with something, right? It's just a system component. And that's a very common use case. And I think possibly for the early part of computing, I think that might have kind of been all anyone thought a font was going to be. I could be wrong about this, but I get that vague sense that that was just kind of what a font on a computer was. It was part of the system, and it influences what your system looks like to you. And so it's installed on the system. Now, I'm pointing this out because in the content creation racket, whether it's creating print ads for billboards or little 30-second spots on television that needs font, that needs writing on it, or the end credit scroll of a movie, or a website, or a video game that's going to show that has tutorial and dialogue in it, like text dialogue, or high score alerts, like whatever, anything with language that needs to be represented by a glyph, a character, the question of what a font is becomes very, very different to you. And I mean, I don't think that you probably even have to have worked in media to have had the experience of getting a file, whether it's a word processor file or a slide deck, or sometimes in some really weird edge cases that should never happen, a PDF. I don't feel like I've seen this myself, but I feel like someone has told me this has happened. But I mean, in PDF. PDF is supposed to be bundled. But anyway, I digress. I think most of us have probably gotten, and I could be wrong, but I feel like it's an almost universal experience to get a file where the font is missing. And now, a lot of times, like probably 98% of the times, you don't even really realize the font is missing because the system gracefully does a quick switcheroo. It notices that a font file is missing. It looks at its little font database and figures out what the closest, or whatever, what the preferred alternative font is, and it just swaps it out. But the effect is that maybe a couple of the words are just slightly, they seem to be laid out a little bit differently. They intrude upon a box, a little colored box over on the right-hand side of the page, whereas you feel like there should be a little bit of a space between them, or maybe the words don't quite fit into the table the way that they look like they were meant to, or whatever. Those are missing fonts. And the reason that those are missing is because the person who created the file didn't select an option somewhere to bundle that font along with the file itself. And this happens more often than it should in media creation. You get a file from someone and your system either tells you or invisibly, silently doesn't tell you and just kind of tries to trick you and make up for it, probably well-meaning, but sometimes really annoying, that it swaps out the font for, you know, just in the background. Point is, you're not seeing what that original person thought you were going to see. And I think that's a really tricky component of fonts that I'm assuming people just didn't really see, they didn't foresee it in early days of computing, because if they did, I feel like we would have built applications a little bit differently. Now, X11, and like I say, I think most operating systems, although I could be wrong because I haven't looked into how macOS and Windows actually manages this stuff, but I believe that the way that generally it happens is that the operating system maintains kind of a font database, or a font server anyway, that is aware of the fonts that it has available to it. And when the renderer is creating the display that you are going to see, it's arranging all the pixels in the right places, it knows what font to pop in for a certain string of characters. And so it renders using that TTF file or OTF file or whatever. Same goes with a web browser. We got web fonts now, thank goodness. And you can have just a TTF or an OTF or a WOTF or a WOFF or something, I don't know, on your web server. And you can put in your CSS to use that font when rendering the page. And it does. It just swaps out, or rather, it renders a string using the characters included in that font file. This concept of kind of having fonts at a system level being served by the graphic server, the graphical display server, that's a pretty common thing, but it does kind of ignore the fact that in some people's cases, they need to extract the font, as it were, from the font server and bundle it with their source, with their media source. Now, there are ways around this. In some cases, I actually can't think of, no, there are, okay, so there are some applications that bundle a font along with the source file. That's great. I think really, honestly, truly, all applications should do that. It's just one of those things, at least, you know, in the design space, applications should simply do that. Like, you're saving this file, you have these fonts included in the file, we're going to make a copy, even if it's redundant, even if I know that you have it on your system, I'm going to copy that font file into your source file so that when that source file leaves your system, it's still got the fonts it needs. That ought to be the default. Maybe it could be an opt-out thing or an opt-in. I guess you could do opt-in. Either way, it should be an option, because too often have I received files that just don't have the fonts included in them, and then that breaks everything. You have to stop, you have to send the person a message, hey, you didn't bundle your fonts, send them over, and then you have to hope that the person knows where their fonts live, how to get them. It's really, truly a pain. So I think that there's a big, big gap in content creation and font management. And this, as it so often does in computing and in the 21st century, this leads to questions of licensing and permission. So back, because I'm theorizing that we all thought that fonts were just a component of the system. At that point, it just seemed like if you purchased the computer, you were also implicitly purchasing the right to use fonts. And generally, that's true. Like, all the fonts on a computer you can use and you print out and you can distribute things with, you know, using the likeness of that font on it, no problem. But some fonts don't want you distributing the actual TTF file or OTF or whatever, the font file, the file that defines what the font is. I don't know why you wouldn't want this to be distributed. Well, I do. I mean, I guess you'd want to sell it. But yeah, I guess that's it. I mean, you want to sell it, which, I mean, it's fair enough, right? You've probably spent several hours, like days, weeks, months, designing a font. I mean, there, because for every font, you have to sit there and draw every single character and every variation of every character and all the characters not on the keyboard, like the whole everything. You need to design the whole thing. I mean, if you want it to be a truly complete font. So yeah, maybe you want to charge for that font file. And so you do want it just to be part of the system and not something that someone uses in a source file. But is that realistic on a computer? Like, I mean, people are creating data on computers. And if I'm creating data and I use the definition of your font in my data, then if I want someone else to be able to replicate the process, I have to send that data along with that font creation along with the data. And so that it's a problem. I mean, personally, I tend to use nothing but open source fonts. I'm not going to say there might be a non-open source font on my system somewhere. I mean, something that got, you know, like installed with something else, maybe. I wouldn't swear to it, but I haven't audited like the licenses of all my fonts, but anything I've personally installed willingly has been open source, and anything that came with Slackware, as far as I know, is open source. So if there is something that's not open source, it would have come along with, I don't know, something else. Again, I can't really imagine what that is, but generally speaking, I just use open source fonts because then I know that if I want to copy my source code, as it were, for a media file, then I can just bundle that font with it. And I do that. When I'm making a project directory or archiving a project that I've been working on, I put the font files in with the project because that font is now part of that project. Whether that font wants to be part of that project or not, it is. I have used the specification of what that font looks like in the project. And so the specification needs to go along with the archive, or else it could get lost, or it'll be misrepresented by someone who's looking at the project or me later on. So font licensing is a big deal. I mean, it's a strangely big deal, which is surprisingly not acknowledged, I think, by a lot of the font foundries out there. I mean, it is in a big way. Like if you go to League of Movable Type, I mean, they are very straightforward about how they really, really intend and want fonts to just stop worrying about your font. They just want it to be something that you can use and redistribute and not worry about. But there are big foundries out there, Adobe being, I guess, the biggest and most obvious, that they don't want you redistributing their fonts. If you use it in a file, like in a Adobe Photoshop image or an InDesign layout thing, then when someone else looks at your file, they had better have just purchased the Adobe licenses, or else they can't see those fonts. At least they shouldn't be able to see those fonts, whether or not you copy the font for them and they just install it and do it that way, who knows. But legally speaking, you're supposed to have purchased that font for your system. And I don't feel, you know, Adobe is egregious at this. I mean, much of their business, I believe, is generated from being maliciously casual about licensing. They make it difficult to get around licensing restrictions, but not so difficult that you can't use their products, because I mean they do need you to be able to use their products. And so I think that they have a very carefully constructed ecosystem to ensure that people can still rely on Adobe products without necessarily giving everything over to Adobe. And they do this very well, and they do it in part also with fonts. They have made sure that their fonts are a lot of their fonts are quite ubiquitous. People take them for granted. It never occurs to anyone that using a proprietary font would ever be a problem, until suddenly that proprietary font becomes part of your wordmark, part of your brand. And then you realize, I don't have the license to use that font as part of my brand. I don't have the license to redistribute that font so that other people involved in this venture can also just type out our brand name or whatever. You know, it's like, it becomes complex, and it becomes, I feel like it's almost like they're specializing in delaying the most unpleasant surprise of, oh, by the way, the thing that you've been relying on this entire time never belonged to you. And if you want to make it easier for your whole team to be able to do this thing, then you need to pay a license fee for everyone. I've had this happen, like, not to me, but I've been on the team of a thing where the original imprint had been done just on, you know, by someone on a Mac probably, and they just used whatever font they had. It was an Adobe font, and it became a serious problem, like to the point of a full rebrand, like a several thousands of dollars, because, you know, everything's several thousands of dollars, several thousands of dollars to rebrand just the word, just the imprint of the brand, so that it didn't use a proprietary font. It was bizarre. And it was one of those things where I just, every step of the way, I just kept thinking, this would not even be a problem if this particular team had just used an open source font in the first place. It's kind of that simple, because then you've got your imprint, you've got contributors or team members who want to contribute and to do the thing. They have access to the font now. It's so easy. But Adobe makes it so easy to not be aware of how difficult it is that you fall into it. And I think that's one of their superpowers. They really truly make it very easy for people to not understand how legally at risk they are every step of the way until it is too late. I don't know why Adobe would want to foster that kind of user experience, but all you have to do, as I've said several times in the past, look online, look at the online forums. People complain about Adobe every day, and they swear that they'll never go back to Adobe, and yet Adobe continues to push forward and forward and forward, and they're doing great. So I don't know. I mean, if Adobe is continually able to call everyone's bluff and make money, I guess that's what Adobe's going to do. Me, I'm going to use open source fonts, and those live both on at a system level and in my user directory. The user directory gets picked up by the font server, and they're available to me in my applications. If there were other users on my Slackware box, which there aren't, they wouldn't have access to the fonts in my user directory, but they would have access to the fonts on the system level. And if they were creating content, I would hope that they would copy it from the system to their home directory or to their project directory and ship that font with their source media. I think that's everything I have to say about font files for now. I mean, until we get into a bunch of other font files. I mean, there are some font configs and things like that that I'll cover in the next episode, but I feel like I think we've covered something like 35 or 40 packages in one episode. That's pretty good. That got me, that made up for several past shortfalls, so that's great. We're on schedule now, I would say. This is going to be, I guess I should just periodically remind you, when I reach the end of the package list of Slackware, this podcast, the one that you're listening to right now, is going to go away. That I'm going to stop production of this podcast so that I can focus on programming and other things. So that's where we're headed. We're probably, I don't know, a good 40 episodes away from that happening, which is a good, 40 weeks? So we have time. I'm just reminding you, if you missed that announcement, that's the case. For now, thank you very much for listening. I appreciate you. Appreciate you listening to the ongoing series here. I hope that you're having a great time with Linux, and I'll talk to you next week.